Rappin' with Reef Bum is sponsored by Champion Lighting and Supply, Polo Reef, and Fauna Marine.
Hey, what's happening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Rappin' with Reef Bum. I'm your host, Keith Berkelhammer. So on today's live stream, I welcome back Dr. Eli Meyer from Aquabiomics. What's happening there, Eli?
How's it going?
Dr. Andrew Bauma, who is a science educator and hobbyist. What's happening there, Andy?
Hey, Keith.
Very much forward to this live stream. Just a quick programming note. Eli double booked himself, so we only have Eli for an hour, but we'll attempt to dig into as much of this information as possible before we lose Eli. So just to set the expectations on that. For those that don't know, Eli is a coral biologist and aquarium hobbyist, and he owns Aquabiomics. Aquabiomics can analyze a microbiome of an aquarium using DNA sequencing, so they can diagnose issues and identify strategies for promoting a healthy microbiome. Andy has a PhD in zoology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and has published research on tropical ecology and science education for the last 16 years. Is that right, Andy? 16 years now?
I've been teaching.
Yeah. Okay.
Introductory biology to undergrad for about 16
years.
Yes.
And
sometimes it feels like it's been longer than that.
I hear you. Andy has kept aquariums for his whole life, but started focusing on saltwater about 12 years ago. Andy currently maintains several systems with a focus on Acropora and Goniopora. No Alveopora? Just Gonies?
I do have some Alveas.
Okay.
But some people say that those are easier for them, but for some reason they don't thrive with my gonies like I would expect.
Interesting. Okay.
Not sure why.
Maybe we need to dig into that with some aquabiomics data. Anyway, Andy is a power user of the Aquabiomics service and has a lot of data on his tanks, a lot of which we will discuss today. But before we start chatting with Eli and Andy, I want to take care of some business and thank the sponsors of this show. My sponsors are really important because they make this show possible with their support, and that means a lot since I want to continue to bring on awesome guests to help foster a learning environment on the show. Champion Lighting and Supply, Todd. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. And I sent Todd some Reef Bum stickers. If you mention Reef Bum when you place an order, he's going to throw a sticker in your order there for you. So that's pretty cool. Appreciate that, Todd. Polo Reef. Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. Imagine a 900-gallon glass drop down aquarium flying in the sky on a giant crane, and then all the anxiety of getting it down a flight of stairs into its final place. Woo. That's what Polar Reef is going to show us as a bonus treat. Be on the lookout for a video drop tomorrow highlighting a special guest podcast. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. And my third sponsor is Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums, from macro elements to trace elements and pollutants. You get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. Okay, with that out of the way.
Just sent one off, Keith.
What's that?
I just sent one off. I just sent one of those off.
Nice. Yeah, I sent one off. I've been doing weekly ICPs, so I sent one off. Claude tells me to send it now on Fridays, that'll speed up the process in terms of getting it to Germany. So I sent my first one on a Friday last week, so we'll see how that goes. But typically I get them in 7 or 8 days. So, all right. So just to make sure everybody can see and hear us, I'm getting this error notification from YouTube. So anybody in the chat want to drop a comment, just let me know that you can still see and hear us. I think we're okay. But sometimes I get these wacky messages here, so YouTube is trying to throw me a curveball tonight, but we will press on. so Eli, man, why don't you start off by telling us if there's anything new with the Aquabiomic Service? You know, we I think the last time we had you on was it a year ago, or was it more recent than that? Maybe it's been about a year or something like that.
11 months.
Time flies. Yeah, I think it's about that. Yeah, so what's new? I'm not sure where we were last time we spoke, but we're solidly in the two batches a month territory these days, which is certainly a change from the early days of the service when we were one batch a month. So our turnaround time has been cut in half since the very earliest days of the service. And I'll say that, you know, when we made that switch to two batches a month, they weren't full batches, which kind of hurt financially on my end. They're full batches now. So the day is coming when we'll be up to three batches a month and have a correspondingly, you know, shorter turnaround time. All of that has kept me very busy running two full batches a month, so I don't have any other exciting development items to share with you. Just cranking away on the samples right
so
now.
So I'm sorry, Eli, I might have missed it. What's like the average turnaround time now one could expect when they send in a sample and get a tank DNA or a microbiome report?
Yeah, so regardless of the test, the turnaround time is now 2 to 4 weeks.
Cool.
And it can be two weeks if you get in right before the cutoff date. That is right before I start grinding up the next batch of samples.
Or if you drive your samples and personally hand them off to Eli at his lab.
That's right. Yeah. Especially if you bribe me with some corals at the same time. That's always useful. Yeah. Yeah, so you know, if you want to optimize your turnaround time, try to get your samples to me mid-month or at the very end of the month, because that's always when I start in these batches.
Gotcha. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Yep. All right. So we're going to be talking a lot about some specific data that Andy put together, and thanks, Andy, for putting together the PowerPoint slides for the show. But Eli, maybe you could also start by just giving a general overview of what people can expect out of a microbiome report. So that's the first slide I've got up on the screen right here.
Yeah, thank you. Let's walk through this because it is kind of information overload. And I often wonder if everyone is clicking on everything that they could be to learn to kind of optimally get information out of this report. Let's walk through it really quickly. On the left-hand side of your screen, you're going to see diversity and balance. These are two kind of summary statistics about the community in your tank. Diversity is the number of different types, and balance is a measure of how normal is that community. What I really want to focus on right now and sort of talk through is the middle of this slide, the community composition. So this is the colorful bar graph, a stacked bar graph, that shows you two different samples, two different communities. On the right, you see the typical sample, and that is really the average of all the healthy mature tanks in our database. And on the left, you see your sample. Now, I like these figures because visually, it's pretty easy to just look at that and say, hey, you know what? This is a pretty normal sample, right? All the major bars that are present in the typical sample, the purple, the orange, the pink, I can look right next door at your sample and say, yeah, you've got those at pretty similar levels to what they are in the typical sample. In this particular sample, it looks like one of these families, the green one, Flavobacteriaceae, was present at a higher level than usual. It's not extreme, but if you look at the graphs, you can see, yeah, that's more green in your sample than the typical one. And here's something I'm not sure if all the clients know about. At some point over the last year, I added a new section to these reports so that you can click on right under Flavobacteriaceae to get additional details about this family. And this is not just going to give you some boilerplate about the family. It's actually going to drill down into the species, the genus and species of each type of Flavobacteriaceae that's in your tank. So often you can learn a lot of really interesting, very specific information about your community by clicking on those links. And I guess that's my overall message about the report is really to learn more, please do explore them thoroughly, expand every section, click on the links. because I've made an effort to provide a lot of detailed information at those links. Now, looking at these community composition profiles in the middle, I want to just point out the colors, because we're going to look at these figures throughout today's show. And so I just want to point out that those major families, the colors will be consistently coded throughout. So when you see the pink bar, that's always Pelagibacteriaceae. The green bar, that's always Flavobacteriaceae. So keep those color codes in mind as we go through. That's what we're going to be pointing at, and it's this figure that gives you the key to those codes. I think I'll stop it there if you want to take it back.
Yeah, I thanks, Eli.
Keith, I see people commenting on our Reef Bum shirts.
Oh, they are.
Yeah. I thought I shouldn't wear my Reef Bum hat, because that would be a little bit too.
No, I'm digging the Reef Beef hat, man.
Two hopes.
Gotta like give shout out to the Reef Beefers out there, right?
Yeah, I got this Reef Beef hat from Macna, Milwaukee. I managed to reach with my long arms and grab it as Ben threw it to the crowd.
Josh Allen, Eli needs a Reef Bum shirt so he can fit in. Yeah.
I do.
And so I have to say that I won this Reef Bum shirt on, I think it was a live with Chris Meckley, when I think you gave out two shirts or something, and I had to be the 15th emailer, and I was lucky and
yeah, man.
Won a shirt with my
name. And then you won some Captivate aquaculture products like the next
and
week.
The next
or something.
Time I won something else. And then my luck ran dry.
Well, I haven't really had any giveaways for a while, so might have to get back into that. It's always a lot of fun. Chris at ACI gave away a whole bunch of coral, which was really cool. And we just got into a giving mood there, so it's it was a lot of fun. So so the one comment I want to make about the snapshot that Eli just went over is that what's really cool about this service is that you can kind of take that snapshot of a tank at any point in time, and you can do some experimenting, right? We're going to be talking about some stuff that that Andy did with ChemiClean and ammonia dosing, and you can do pre-post studies, so you can kind of like see what a tank looks like in terms of the microbiome or tank DNA before you make a change to the tank, and then you you send in that test to Aquabiomics, and then you do something to the tank. You start dosing something or you start doing some sort of treatment, and then you kind of see what the impact is afterwards. So, you know, that's kind of like a basic scientific pre-post type of analysis. And then there's other types of analyses that that you can do also that, are very insightful. So I think what I'm trying to say is that this can be a very customizable service, and that just the straight data that you get out of the two main reports, the tank DNA report and the microbiome report, give us a lot of tools to help analyze our tanks, which I think is really a cool thing.
Yeah. When I first started the service, I had this vision of all these cool experiments I wanted to run. And every time I have a conversation with Reef Keepers, we come up with a dozen more cool experiments we want to run. And I never have the time to run the experiments. So I'm really grateful to people like Andy who use the service specifically to do these experiments. You know, we've got some cool data today to talk about. I'm just the one sequencing the DNA, but the experiments make sense of it. Right? And I think they're going to help a lot for the hobby in terms of teaching us more about which bacteria are good and bad, which bacteria respond to different treatments.
So Andy, what do you want to start with, man? I think there's two that really have got my interest piqued, which is the ammonia dosing experiment as well as the ChemiClean one.
I think it makes sense to start with the time series for my frag tank, because we'll talk about some things that we'll return to in the other figures.
All right, man, the floor is yours, Andy.
Okay, so a lot of times people ask, how do I use this service? There's a bit of a wait time. You send in your sample, you sit and you have to wait for Eli to run the PCRs and have it sent off to the sequencing facility and get data back. So oftentimes buyers ask, what can I do with this information? I'm not going to get it within 5 days. I'm not going to get it tomorrow. Well, one really effective thing that you can do is one really useful thing you can do is use it to evaluate a new system as you set it up. And as it goes through the ugly phase, as it goes through a cycle, I can't see on my end, Keith, have you put up that figure yet? Or
not
no?
yet.
Okay.
It's up now.
It's up. Okay, great. And so what you see here are data from a new frag system that I set up. And I set it up with a combination of some live rock, some dry rock, and water change water. Because one of the things that Eli has found is that all the bacterial families are actually found in the water itself. And so I wanted to see if I could speed up the cycle, skip the ugly phase, by starting out with all water from my mature system, my mature display tank. And I failed miserably.
Oh, we lost you there for a second.
I got the data.
Can you repeat that last sentence there, Andy? I think you kind of blipped out a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So it was about a year ago that I got the data back I got the first data back, 429.23. And you can see that if you compare that to the graphs that we looked at just a minute ago, it's quite different. Mm. So this was the first, this was 2 months, almost 3 months in to this frag tank that I had set up. It had no sand, rocks, dry rock, and water change water. It's got a big green band, Flavobacter ACA, a tiny, tiny pink band, Pelagibacter ACA, very large orange band, Rotobacter ACA. And so this to me is an abnormal family. It was in the 20th percentile for diversity. It was 24th percentile for balance. So very low correlation with a mature, healthy reef tank microbiome. And so I got the data back. I said, nope, not ready for sensitive corals yet. I had hoped that it would look just like one of the mature graphs that we saw a minute ago, because I had added everything. I had added the water that had lots of Pelagibacter ACA, but it just didn't stick. It just didn't stay. And I proceeded to go through months of uglies.
struggle. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I did a similar thing. I tried to seed some carob sea life rock in a Rubbermaid tub to put into one of my systems. And I did water changes with, I filled the 100-gallon Rubbermaid tub up. Maybe half of it was established tank water and the other half was like fresh salt water that I mixed up. But I did weekly water changes with established tank water. I was dosing bacteria to that thing. I think I had that soaking in the Rubbermaid tub with that process going on for like 6 months, and then I put the rock into the display tank, and man, it was just like excuse my French, it was a shit show. I had these green algaes, I had cyano, I had bubble algae, and it's just I'm still kind of struggling with it, but I just wanted to interject that it seemed like cooking the rock, the dry rock, in established tank water was good in theory, but it didn't seem to play out in terms of actuality.
So the funny thing, Keith, is that this is almost exactly how I set up my display tank from other previous systems. The only difference was that I didn't have any sand. This is a totally bare bottom system. So if you go back to that graph, you can see then the next microbiome snapshot is another even weirder graph. The correlation with the regular microbiome is like less than 1%. Again, very low diversity. It's one of the weirdest. It's, I think, one of the weirdest microbiomes that I've seen yet. And at the time, there was dinoflagellates everywhere. There was all kinds of weird chrysophyte algae everywhere. It just looked like a disaster. And nope, not ready for sensitive corals yet. And so I had to wait longer. And then finally, towards the end of 2023, things started to clear up. And on 131.24, I got a sample back. And that was when the stable community arrived. And then I put my sensitive acros in there. And they have, the color has been incredible. The growth has been really, really good. And I haven't had any issues.
What do you attribute that to? Do you just think time was really the main factor in terms of kind of?
It's not just time, because I've talked to I've been helping people interpret the Rocobiomics reports, and I have talked to a number of people that have, if they set up their tank with dry rock and added bottled bacteria, some people take, it's over a year and they still have a really weird microbiome, and they just can't get anything to do well in their tank. And so this took time, but I also had the correct ingredients. I think the reason why, so this took about 2 months longer than my display tank to reach a stable microbiome with a nice big pink band, a nice smaller green band of Flavobacteriaceae, a red band of Alteromonadaceae, and a smaller orange band of Rotobacteriaceae. It took about 2 months longer to reach that stable community than my display tank. I think the difference is because I don't have sand in it. And so it took about 2 months longer. So I think that in the future, if I set up a frag tank, I might do some kind of a remote sand bed, because I don't want to have to deal with the mess of the sand bed long term.
Cryptic sump.
But it's certainly
cryptic sump.
Something like that with sand. Yeah, something like that with live sand. Yeah. I think that could be a key to help speed up the cycle.
I don't want to interrupt, but thanks to Wonder Water for that super chat. Appreciate that. All right, Andy.
Yeah, it's a great example, what you just showed us, Andy. You know, hobbyists go to forums and we read, we try to find rules for how to set up our tanks. Rules like, well, if I wait X months, that will be long enough. Or if I put in this ingredient, that will make it happen. And as we're discussing, you know, there's some variation in the outcome, right? It may take longer in one tank than another. And how can you know it? How can you know if your tank is ready? I think your data set is a nice demonstration that how you can know if your tank is ready is to directly measure the community, rather than just following the rule that may not behave exactly in your tank as it did in somebody else's tank.
Yeah. And just to add on to that, so if you watched us a year ago, what I showed was about, I think it might have been about 15 microbiome snapshots over 4 years from my display tank, which is over here. And in the display tank, you saw a similar thing where there was a cycling period. It settled into a stable microbiome with a big pink band of Pelagibacteriaceae, a couple other key bands. And over time, it was very stable, except when I had problems in the tank. So I had some brown jelly, I had some STN. And during those times, the ratio of the orange band, the Rotobacteriaceae, to the Plagiobacteriaceae got really turned around, so that I had mostly Rotobacteriaceae. And I learned to recognize that as a warning sign that I had too much detritus, too much dissolved organic carbon in the tank, and I needed to do a major major correction. And so looking at the data from the frag tank, I see that graph and immediately I see that I'm right where I want to be, because I've got a big pink band, a small orange band, and it's been the same for the frag tank. The corals have been thriving since I've arrived at that community.
So Rich Colombo has a question, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase this question, but what about these dry rock unstable systems in terms of running ozone and UV? You know, what do you guys think in terms of if you started with UV and ozone or one or the other for a brand new dry rock only type of system? You know, how could that potentially impact the microbiome or the system itself?
Yeah. You know, I don't have data from exactly that experiment, but based on what we've learned, I think we can predict that that would remove the bacteria plankton from the system. So the Pelagibacteraceae, this pink band that we keep pointing at, they're entirely bacteria plankton. That is freely swimming around in the water, not attached to surfaces. So I think we can expect that you'd be clearing those out in a new system with UV or ozone. My prediction is it would make the whole process take longer as a result. I'd also kind of question the rationale. I mean, if we're using these things primarily to remove parasites and pathogens, if it's a new tank and you're waiting to stock it, I mean, you shouldn't have parasites and pathogens in it yet. In any case, yeah, that's my take on it. I wouldn't be in favor of it as a prophylactic measure that you take on a dry rock starting tank. I think that it's going to slow down your cycling process. I think there's a good reason to believe that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
go ahead, Andy.
Could I just add something quickly, Keith? So having a UV sterilizer is not going to bring the microbes from the ocean that you need to your tank, right? Those the microbes that you need for that stable community, they don't just all come out of the air. They appear to come from live rock and from frags and from things that have been in the ocean. And so you may have a UV sterilizer or ozone that helps control some of the dinoflagellate outbreaks and stuff, but you still may never arrive at that climax community that Eli has shown from his testing. So you may never get where you need to go to have that stable microbiome.
Yeah, we've talked about this before when you guys have been on, or maybe I was talking about it with Eli when he was on solo, but in terms of the use of UV on a mature reef tank, I've gone back and forth on that, but I've been doing it now for a while. And Steve Wiest, I know, is also another proponent of using UV on an established reef tank. And certainly I've seen that data, Eli, in terms of that microbiome, that pink bar really kind of shrinking when you're using the UV. So I guess the question is, for an established reef tank, what potentially can be the impact on corals, specifically LPS corals or SPS corals? Have we seen anything, any data that syncs up across different customers' tanks that show some sort of, I guess, relationship between that small little pink band and some long-term issues with corals, or do we just not have enough data at this point?
Yeah, I don't have enough. I think ultimately what you're asking is, do we have data on the benefits of this group, the necessity of this group for growing corals? I don't think we have good data to answer the question. I think it's clear that you can have a successful reef tank with healthy corals with a UV sterilizer. Yeah. I think there's enough people in the hobby doing this that it would be pointless to try to argue against that. But what I think we're lacking are comparisons, within that tank. If you turned off the UV for a year, how would your corals do?
And not change anything else, right? Pretty much.
That's right. Don't change anything else. Just turn off the UV. Few people are willing to do such an experiment, especially if they start seeing a downside on their corals, right?
Actually, Eli, Steve was just at my house this past weekend. Cool. And he was telling me about, he did this to his tank. He turned his UV off, not for a year, turned his UV off for about a month and a half. And Steve has a lot of really nice fish in his tank.
I see.
And they weren't all fully quarantined. And so he uses UV to manage ick.
Yeah.
And he saw flashing from his Achilles tang. He saw some things that looked like they were a result of him turning off the UV. So I would say in Steve's tank, there's definitely a role for UV if you have, if you've got issues with ick in your tank.
He also mentioned to me, I don't know if it was on my stream or if it was a conversation we were having, that he did a microbiome report with the UV and without the UV, and he saw the presence of cyano in the report. He didn't see the physical physically he didn't see the cyano in his tank, but that kind of scared him. that there was actually some sort level of cyano in the report. So that was another thing.
Well, I've got some news for Steve. Uh-oh. You can get cyano with UV on.
Yeah, that's I absolutely concur.
So, you know, this discussion of Steve's tank is a good example of what I was talking about, why we don't have data, right? Because Steve saw issues with his fish, so he reasonably decided to turn his UV back on. So we will never know what would the impact have been on Steve's corals if he'd continued the experiment. Yeah.
So I think one thing we didn't mention, Eli, is that one of the arguments for having a robust Pelagibacteraceae band is that we know corals preferentially feed on Pelagibacteraceae. Right. And so it's coral food. The thing that corals eat the most of in the ocean is the Cyanicococcus single-celled cyanobacteria, but Eli doesn't find those in our reef tanks. Right. And so
at least low levels.
Yeah, low levels.
Yeah.
And so, you know, presumably something else in Steve's tank is feeding his corals, but we don't know. We don't know what that is.
Go ahead, Eli.
Yeah, I'll say my rationale for wanting this group actually started before I even knew about that paper that Andy brought to my attention. And that is, in every other respect, we try to mimic the coral reef habitat in our tanks, right? We're trying to give them light that's adequate and similar high light levels, right? We're trying to measure water chemistry and make that similar to the reef. So even without knowing anything about why might this group be important, as soon as I saw that there's this group that's one of the most abundant on natural reefs, and some people are doing something to their tank that just obliterates that group, right away I said that may not be optimum. You know, if we're trying to match the natural habitat, a UV sterilizer certainly takes your microbiome in the opposite direction of the natural microbiome. We can keep talking about how much does that matter, but that was my rationale, is I'm trying to mimic what they encounter in nature.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I want to be sensitive of your time, Eli. We've only got 25 more minutes of you. So, Andy, should we jump into...
Yeah, let's...
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
So go ahead to the next slide.
Ammonia dosing?
I think is the before and after ammonia dosing, right. So I think you had Sanjay and Mike Paletta.
And they're going to be on next week, too.
They were talking about how they were dosing ammonia to their tanks instead of nitrate. Yeah. And I've dosed nitrate to my tank for a long time, quite a bit of nitrate. And so I thought, hey, well, maybe I'll try what they're doing to see what that does. And Sanjay said, hey, you should do a microbiome before and after and see what it does to the community. And a little side note here is that my microbiome looks weird, because I was gone to Hawaii and I had someone tank sitting who fed a lot of pellets. My phosphate spiked from like 0.08 up to like 0.5. So it's a pretty fast phosphate spike. And I came back from Hawaii and I had hair algae everywhere in the tank. And so that big green band, Flavobacteriaceae, it looks like that when you have a hair algae bloom in your tank. And so I still have the Pelagibacteriaceae and the other normal families there, but they're being kind of consumed by the Flavobacteriaceae. So if you can get past that, you can see that's the before data. The ammonia oxidizing microbes, 0.1068. Nitrite oxidizing bacteria, 0.0005. I started dosing ammonium bicarbonate for 2 weeks, and I took another snapshot, and the algae had receded a little bit, so Flavobacteriaceae is a little bit more normal looking. And the really interesting thing was that my ammonia oxidizing microbes did not go up. So Eli and I predicted they would go up.
Right.
The nitrite oxidizing bacteria were similar, a little bit higher. But the other part of the story is that my coral growth increased like crazy over those 2 weeks.
That's not a bad thing.
My alkalinity.
That's not a bad thing.
No, it's not a bad thing.
That's what Sanjay said too.
Yeah. Well, I was texting with Sanjay yesterday, and he said, we were like, we can't afford to continue doing this ammonia dosing thing because our supplements are going through the supplement costs are going through the roof. Like I've had I've had to increase my elk and calcium dosing by more than 50% over the 3 months that I've been doing it, and that my cropper are growing really fast. To finish that thought, so basically, the coral growth, increased alkalinity and calcium consumption suggests that all that extra ammonia is being gobbled up by the corals and it's not going to the microbes, because the microbes, the ammonia oxidizing bacteria didn't change, even though I started adding all this ammonia.
Yeah, I was shocked by that. I was sure your nitrifiers were going to go up, but I agree with your interpretation. You know, it's not going there. It's got to be going somewhere else. The nitrifying microbes, their population size is controlled by the amount of nutrients available for them. So if their population size didn't go up, they didn't have more nutrients available. Seems like pretty clear data that it went to your corals. Yeah.
So
you'll just have to bring me more coral friends.
Some of my corals, I swear, like if I go away for the weekend and I come back, like, oh, wow. Yeah.
That's a nice
3 days.
That's a nice feeling. just a couple of quick thanks to Rob Upstate New York for that very generous super chat. Keep live streaming, Keith. Thank you, Rob. Ben Johnson, thank you, man, for that very generous super chat. Captive Aquatic.
So thank Ben Johnson for this hat.
Yeah, beef hat. Yeah. So a couple things about ammonia dosing. Based on what you're saying, this was a success for you, and you're going to continue to do it, Andy?
I'm going to continue to do it because I like to see my corals grow fast. The other thing is that Sanjay said that several, and Mike also shared that several people have told them that their nutrients have gone down because of the increased coral growth. And so I'm hoping it makes my phosphate go down a little bit, as I've still been dosing lanthanum chloride to keep it at about 0.1. So it'd be nice if I didn't have to do that.
So for people that are thinking about doing this, a couple of things. One is, what would you say nutrients should be in a tank to consider ammonia dosing? You know, at what levels, you know, if you've got high levels of, you know, nitrates and phosphates, is this something you should be thinking about? If you've got nitrates and phosphates that are, you know, very low levels, is that something that comes into consideration? You should not be thinking about ammonia dosing?
Well, in my case, my tanks, for some reason, if I don't supplement nitrogen, I always end up with quite low nitrates. Phosphate tends to stay high, and nitrates tend to be low. And so all my systems, I dose nitrate, except when they're brand new. And then both nitrate and phosphate tend to be low for a while.
So in
my system, without dosing nitrate, my nitrate would be very low. And I stopped dosing nitrate, started dosing ammonia, and I've seen this explosion in growth.
At what level would you say you can safely start dosing ammonia? In 10 parts per million nitrates, over 10 parts per million? You know, if is that okay if you've got, you know, one part per million or five parts per million? I mean,
I don't think it matters. I mean, you're if there's nothing wrong with providing more nitrogen to your system, right?
Right. I guess
so. I don't think it matters if you have low nitrogen and low nitrates.
Right. I guess my question is, like, at what level of nitrates would it be kind of risky to start doing this? Like, if you've got high nitrates in the 20 part per million range, is that just kind of like, you know, there's no sense in dosing ammonia nitrate?
Well, okay. So Mike Paletta shared with me that he has some issues with higher nitrates, but he just doses vodka too.
Mm.
And so he keeps his nitrates down with vodka, doses ammonia to fuel the corals.
I was going to say that's a kind of a little complicated dance.
Yeah. You know, I'm actually, my nitrates have, I like to keep my nitrates between like 5 to 10 PPM. And right now my nitrates are like 1. So that tells me I need to increase my ammonia dosing. Yeah. So I have some nitrate produced at the tail end of the nitrogen cycle.
Yeah.
So the other thing was that I share a lot of these data on Instagram. So you can find me on Instagram, and I posted the source of ammonium bicarbonate. It's 50 gram. Well, actually, I don't remember exactly. So you better go look at my post, because I can't remember exactly what it is. But I got the solution and instructions from Mike and Sanjay, and that I've been slowly increasing it.
Gotcha. Thanks to Ryan Jensen for that super chat. Hello to my brothers, Andy, and thanks for the great content, Keith. Oh, yeah.
So Ryan's the guy that has the shirt just like this. It says Ryan, and we always get confused.
You guys look
at our
alike.
Local club meeting. That's what people say.
And you say.
And so when I went to Reefstock, Ryan texted me because I got there late. He had been there earlier. He said three people already have come up to me and called me Andy, including Ben Johnson.
And you guys have both. The Reef Bum work shirt and the Reef Bum hat. So, and you sent me a picture of that. I was like, holy crap, man, you guys really just are twins. Brittany Gherkin, thank you so much for that super chat. So Gary Cumbo, you know, makes a point. I was going to mention this. Sounds like a dangerous idea to dose ammonia in the tank. Talk to us about the risks of ammonia dosing.
Well, it's dangerous to have fish in your tank because fish produce ammonia as waste. So you better have your fish poop somewhere else and pee somewhere else if you're afraid of ammonia in the tank.
You can overdose, and that could be a potential risk.
In theory, you could, but I obviously have tons of leeway in my system. So Sanjay shared with me that he was dosing like, I think, 0.24 mLs per gallon, I think. Is that right? 0.24 mLs per gallon, which is about 50% more than what I'm doing yet. So I have a long ways to go. But Sanjay has a lot of, you know, growth in his tank. So he's probably on the high end of things.
It seems to me like you can mitigate that danger by kind of ramping up your dosing. But I wouldn't want to overnight do a big, massive dose of ammonia to the tank. But if you kind of slowly ramp up, I totally agree with Andy's point. I mean, every fish in your tank is constantly oozing out ammonia 24/7. So the dose makes the poison.
Salem,
certainly.
Thank you so much for that super chat. Glad to see the oracles are back on. This is the future of the hobby.
I think Salem is the future of the hobby.
Yeah, that's right.
How does it do, guys?
So what was I going to say? I lost my train of thought. Oh, in terms of the ammonia dosing, the age of the tank. Young tanks, not a good idea?
I think that it depends on how many coral. I mean, you need to have enough corals to take up the ammonia. If you don't have the corals taking it up, then you need to have the ammonia oxidizing bacteria to take it up.
Yeah.
So if it's a tank without a lot of corals, then perhaps there is more of a risk. You have a lot of fish, not that many corals. You don't have as big of a population of beneficial bacteria, perhaps.
Yeah.
But if you go slowly, I think, if you go slowly, then the ammonia oxidizing bacteria will ramp up in population, I think. So I think it seems fairly safe if you go slowly.
I think it's worth mentioning the third major group in everyone's aquarium that also takes up ammonia, and that is anything photosynthetic, all of your algae. So if you have a macroalgae refugium, that's another sink for ammonia. Constantly pulling it out of your water. If you have a hair algae scrubber, this kind of thing. So Andy's data on coral growth clearly show that some of it was making it into the corals. Perhaps some also made it into algae. And that would be my concern in a young tank. Exactly like Andy's saying, if you don't have much coral biomass, it's going to go somewhere. It's either going to go into the bacteria or into the algae. And especially in a young tank, you don't want to be fueling, algal growth.
John Wright makes a good point in this question. Why not add more fish to add ammonia?
Well, I don't know if you can see that well, but I have 12 fish in this tank, and some of them are like that big. Actually, you could show my tank videos at some point.
Keith, my fish are in the tank. I completely forgot about that. Here's Andy's tank.
John, I've got a lot of fish in that tank. some of them, every time they poop, it's like that big floating in the water.
I'm showing your tank so they couldn't see your yeah. That was about
one of them is the display tank and one of them is the frag tank.
Yeah, this is up showing a display tank video. Beautiful tank, man. Beautiful tank. Brian Washington, thank you so much for that super chat. 4 years old. Yeah.
4 years old, yeah.
So there's a Naso Tang, huge Naso Tang. That's probably grown, probably, right, since you've added those Naso Tangs can grow quickly.
Yeah.
Doesn't bump in a lot of stuff?
Oh, it frags more corals than I do.
And here's the...
I bring the results of its fragging, of its tail fragging to Eli sometimes.
And here's the frag tank that we were talking about before, which is also chock full. I see some beautiful Oregon blue tort mini colonies in there, man.
Yeah, you notice they're square. You know how they grow like that? When they've been fragged weekly for about a year.
There you go. They become very resilient. Very yes. resilient corals, and that's the beauty of captive grown corals. Polo 1126, thank you so much for the super chat. Keep up the great streams and awesome guests. Love the discussion. All right, so we've got about 10 more minutes of Eli here. So should we switch gears and get into the ChemiClean discussion?
Yeah, let's look at that. Okay. So Keith and I have been having this long-term dialogue about the bane of our existence, which is cyanobacteria, mm-hmm. or at least it has been at some point, probably every reefer's bane of every reefer's existence. Cyanobacteria, what do you do about it? And I thought, well, I have some cyanobacteria and I have easy access to a microbiome testing service. Many people, many reefers over the years have reported their tank being stressed out by ChemiClean treatment. And since I think Boomer, the famous reefer Boomer in 2009, I think, discovered that ChemiClean is erythromycin, which is an antibiotic. It's a gram-positive targeting antibiotic, fairly broad spectrum. Interestingly, it's really good at killing cyanobacteria, which are gram-negative, but it possibly could do all kinds of things to the microbiome. Can you see this slide up
yet
on YouTube?
Yeah, no, it's up. Yep.
Oh, okay. Whoops. I guess I forgot. I lost my place here. I didn't hit play, so I can't see it. Okay.
Just hit live. You should be able to see it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so what you see are there's a before and after on the left and then a before and after on the right. And I'll talk about the one on the left first. So the before and after on the left is the pre-microbiome before I treated my tank with ChemiClean. And you can see it's kind of how my tank had been for a while, a big Pelagibacteraceae band, but also a really big Rhodobacteraceae band. And Eli and I have been talking about how as the tank ages, it appears that the Rhodobacteraceae band, which these are bacteria that like a lot of detritus and surfaces, seems like it creeps up over time. And it may be a marker of old tank syndrome. But anyway, so around this time, I was having some trouble with cyanobacteria. And I thought, well, I'll test what ChemiClean does. And so I treated my tank with ChemiClean and went through the normal recommended treatment. And you can see the data. And so it took my microbiome, and I was pretty shocked by what it did, because it took my microbiome and kicked it into exactly the opposite direction as I wanted it to be, because the microbiome in the system, I like it to have a big pink band, a small orange band, and then decent sized red bands and green bands for the other major families. And it shrunk my Pelagibacteraceae. For some reason, it killed most of my Pelagibacteraceae, which resulted in the Rhodobacteraceae band getting really big. And took the balance scored from 97% down to 85%. And so did a bunch of things that I didn't like to my microbiome. It did, however, wipe out the cyanobacteria. So it effectively killed the cyanobacteria. That disappeared after the two-day period. It also it reduced the ammonia oxidizing bacteria a little bit. They went down from 0.0328 to 0.0141, but that is still within the average population range. So that wasn't harmful. It also didn't have much of an impact on the nitrate oxidizing bacteria. One interesting thing is that there are a couple of SCTLD associated bacteria that were in the tank, and it brought them down a little bit with treatment. So it did what it was supposed to do. However, everything was stressed out, like during this several day period while it was being treated. Corals lost polyp extension. I had a couple frags that died, including one I got from Keith, which Keith tells me is fairly sensitive. It was the ACI pink spat.
Yeah, but that's an awesome
chemically treatment wiped it out, plus another coral that I don't remember. And so it was obvious that my coral population was stressed. And now it makes sense looking at the microbiome. It pulled the Pelagibacteriaceae mainly out of the water, increased Rhodobacteriaceae. The tank eventually recovered from that, and my corals were fine. But then the cyanobacteria came back.
I was going to ask you, when did the cyano come back?
So was it worth it?
No.
I don't think so. Will I do it again? No. It's a broad-spectrum antibiotic. It did the opposite thing that I wanted to have happen to my population. I ended up beating the cyanobacteria by reducing my light cycle length. And it hasn't come back since then. Sorry, go ahead, Eli.
Yeah, it really looks like it did kind of what we would expect, right? It killed what you were hoping it to kill, but had lots of off-target effects, right? It distorted the community, specifically killing a lot of the bacteria plankton. Yeah.
And
kind of a sledgehammer.
And before we lose Eli in a few minutes, OA.
Yeah, so oxalic acid. So everybody should look at Coral Magazine this next month, May. Amanda Meckley has done a great job of writing up. She and Chris's and Jake Adams and Julian Sprungs. And it's a big group working on using this antibiotic to treat. Originally, it was for Elegans coral syndrome. And basically, they worked with an aquatic veterinarian and came up with a protocol for treating large systems with Elegans corals. And so right around the time that they were starting to reach out to people in the industry, I had some slow tissue necrosis in my display tank. And Chris came on with Keith, talked about it a little bit, and I reached out to Keith, and Keith shared me the protocol. And so again, I like to test things on my tank. I wouldn't normally do this, except I wanted to see what the data are. Now that I have the data, I probably won't do this again. But you can see the data for my tank. On the left, I have a terrible looking microbiome. This was a time, again, I had disease in the tank, slow tissue necrosis. Look at my Rhodobacteriaceae band is huge. The Pelagibacteriaceae band is totally gone. I have Mycobacteriaceae, this color here, which causes disease in humans. Treated it according to Chris Meckley's protocol, and then it brought back the families that I like to see in my microbiome. It also reduced, it basically stopped the STN for a time. And
for a time, meaning you started
for a time,
you started getting RTN STN again.
It wasn't really RTN, it was STN. I'll say it stopped for months, and I removed the pieces that were showing it, and it hasn't really come back.
Okay.
I'll talk more about that in a minute, but I think we need to give Eli his last say here before he has to go.
Yeah,
I mean, I'll just echo what you said about these. As I look at these these microbiome profiles, it's clear that the OA treatment, not only did it not harm the microbial community, I would actually say it was a real benefit, right? Your balance score went dramatically up. And we can see this visually in the community because we have the pink Pelagibacteriaceae and the green Flavobacteriaceae. So yeah, to my eye, this looks like a profoundly better treatment. I will say these are both single tank experiments, so it would be great to get more involvement from the hobby, you know, from the community. It would be great to add to this data set, but very convincing data that OA in your tank didn't hurt anything, and in fact seems to have been quite.
Hey, Eli, before we lose you in a couple minutes, just in theory, you know, I've heard people say that if you're not going to use the antibiotics or whatnot, do large water changes and remove the infected coral. In theory, you know, not saying that we have data to back all that stuff up, but in theory, are those good, you know, methods to try to beat back RTN-STN?
I think there's some logic to them. I mean, reducing the dose of pathogens is going to have a benefit. A big water change, I'm a little bit skeptical about whether that would be the top priority, because most of the pathogens that we find, while yes, they're transmitted through the water, they're found at relatively low levels in the water. I suspect if we could count all the cells in the aquarium, most of the pathogens are stuck to corals. So for my money, the best way you could pull pathogens out of your tank is taking infected corals out of your tank. I might not spend so much time on water changes.
Gotcha. Makes sense. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, Eli, we're going to let you go because I know we got a hard stop. But thanks, Matt, again, for joining us. Always a pleasure having you on. And
yeah, thank you. Really appreciate it. And I'm sorry to have to bail. I'll avoid the overbooking problem next time.
Yeah. All
thanks,
right, Eli.
Guys.
See you later.
Have a good one. See you soon. All right, so I'm going to try to, like, blip out Eli, but I might, or we could just leave the frozen shot of Eli. That looks like a good shot of him.
We look like twins, though.
Yeah, we'll leave Eli's frozen shot up there. That shot up there, that'll be fine, versus, like, a Skype logo.
So Keith, let me follow up. So I talked about that I used an antibiotic on my tank. Let me follow it up with a little disclaimer. So I have antibiotics on the shelf as a last ditch kind of thing to save my tank. I've got something really bad going on. As I said, I did this test basically to collect some data so we would know what it did. And so now we have that data. And I often describe the use of antibiotics as a tool, like a fire extinguisher to use in an emergency. You don't whip out the fire extinguisher for every little thing that happens every day. You keep it for the serious thing, the serious fire that's going to burn your house down. And so I still, I do a number of things. I do dips in iodine if I have, if I'm concerned about some signs of antibiotic infection. I also do dips in oxalic acid. And I do dips. I've done a number of concentrations, some really high concentrations for gonies, but about 2 grams per gallon of tank water of oxalic acid, baths with aeration, and you have to heat the water if you have cold air temperatures, from 4 to 6 hours baths for a number of corals. That's been quite effective, and I do it every other day, 3 times, just like the in-tank treatment. And that's been very effective. It's much better to take the corals out of your tank, treat them in a bath, and that way you avoid having negative impacts on your tank, and potentially you avoid doing repeated treatments on your tank, which could lead to resistant bacteria.
Hey, Remy's in the house. What's happening, Remy? Back from Australia, I guess.
Remy's jet lagged, I
think.
Yeah,
those are great points, Andy. I think... you know, that's that, and in terms of like removing the infected corals, I think what I've found, at least with SPS, is that if you can frag the coral, the healthy tissue, and try to get as many frags as possible, you can certainly have better than a 50% odds, I think. Well, I can't say that. there's a chance you could save the coral by fragging it multiple times, and maybe one frag will survive. That's been my experience, at least. But I also think it's important to say that, well, first of all, thanks to Amanda and Chris Meckley for all that they have put into this oxalic acid research. I know a lot of people have been reaching out to me about the oxalic acid protocol. You know, I pass it along to you, Andy, because you're a scientist, and so I know that you're utilizing it in a with the you know, you're using scientific rigor, right? In terms of
I like to think
employing
so.
The protocol, but I think a lot of people might you know, see some part of a coral bleaching and all of a sudden hit the panic button and be like, I gotta hit this thing with antibiotics because so-and-so did that and said that it saved their tank and all that sort of thing. But, you know, I think now that the article is out in Coral Magazine, that people, as a last resort, and, you know, again, it's not something that people should be doing without doing other things first. You know, there is now an in-tank treatment protocol as well as a dip protocol that can be followed in that Coral Magazine article. But yeah, you know, I think ICP testing is important. You know, there could be issues with, you know, certain traces and miners being out of whack that could be causing the coral, you know, RTN, STN. There could be a whole number of factors that are going on. Stability is always a big key. You know, if there's big swings in salinity, temperature, alkalinity, you know, these are all things that can cause corals to you know, start having issues and giving the coral pathogens kind of a that entry point to take over a tank. So I think it's really important to emphasize that antibiotics should be a last resort, like you said, something that is a should be done, that if it's a serious situation, you're losing your tank.
Yeah, and just a follow-up about oxalic acid specifically, it's a first-generation quinolone antibiotic, and so it's related to Cipro, but it's different. And the main difference from Cipro is there's some chemical structure differences, but it's a little bit narrower in what it targets than Cipro. And importantly, it's not used in human medicine around the world like Cipro is. Cipro is a very medically important antibiotic. And so Cipro, which is what many people have been using on their tanks, is something that the FDA is cracking down on.
Yeah.
You now need to have a prescription to get access to it, whereas oxalic acid is, you don't need that. And it's just riskier because it's an important antibiotic for human medicine. So if reefers develop some resistant strains of bugs to Cipro, it, you know, potentially it's a bigger hazard to human health.
Right. And that's an important point. So Amanda's just saying Coral Magazine next issue will have the bath and in-tank OA treatment protocols, right? So I guess it's not out yet, or it's coming out real soon.
I think coming out in May.
Okay. So yep. We're jumping the gun a little bit there. Some next week.
That's just a week.
Yeah. Do we have anything else we want to talk about, Andy, in terms of the ChemiClean and the OA?
I think a couple things that I try to do to when I'm approaching cyanobacteria problems, I try to make sure that I have a good ratio of nitrate to phosphate. I shoot from anywhere to between like 150 and 50 to 1 nitrate to phosphate ratio. When you tend to get lower nitrate relative to higher phosphate, I think you're more likely to run into issues with nuisance microbes like cyanobacteria or dinoflagellates. And so that's something you want to look at first. Having too long of a light cycle is also something that contributes to cyanobacteria. I noticed that my cyanobacteria was appearing late in the light cycle. And sure enough, I backed it off by a little bit and it disappeared. So there's a few things you can try before you reach for something like an antibiotic.
Like Chemiclean. Yeah.
Chemiclean.
And the other thing that Claude from Fauna Marine has always has talked about is the halogens, you know, fluorine, iodine, and bromide, to make sure that I think it's if two out of those three are out of whack, then potentially that can open the door for cyano. So I still have some pesky cyano in one of my systems. And
did he think it was high iodine?
So very low iodine. I had very low iodine levels in the system, and that's because I stopped dosing it because I had incredibly high iodine levels, and he thought that the very, very high iodine levels were a possible cause of the cyano. So I stopped dosing it, and I stopped dosing it, it had been a while since I was dosing it, and the levels just got way down to like 0.03, which is pretty darn low for iodine. I think I want to say anything above, well, I don't know the exact level in terms of what is I'd have to look that up in terms of what's a satisfactory iodine level, but mine was super low.
I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, mine was super low. So I'm working to get that up. But I also think, just some basic things in terms of siphoning out detritus. I, every other day, blow my rocks with a power head and try to get any detritus on. I've got bare bottom tanks, so I try to get the detritus up in the water column, get it removed, either siphoning it out or get it into the overflow box to have the mechanical filtration help remove it. I think weekly water changes are very important. You know, at least 5 to 10% can help. So I think there's a lot of things that can be done to help try to remove cyano without the chemical intervention. And I think detritus is a big source of it. Usually in my Peninsula tank, I don't get a lot of cyano, but the couple of spots that I do see it, it's basically forming on top of the little piles of detritus that I, hadn't siphoned out.
Yeah, cyano it's mysterious. It's kind of like, it fills a little ecological niche in your tank. And sometimes it seems like if you can, like I've heard of people talking about doing blackouts for a day or two, getting the cyano to disappear, and then something gets into its ecological niche, and it doesn't allow it to come back.
That didn't work.
Even though the conditions in your tank are similar,
man, didn't work for me, man. Because I'm resetting my my 187 gallon display tank, and so I had all corals were basically out of that tank, and I had some cyano in there. I was like, you know what? I'm going to do a 7-day blackout to get rid of that cyano once and for all, and it was looking good for a few days after that blackout, but then a couple of weeks later the cyano came back. So I don't know, man. It
I'm afraid to do that long of a blackout.
Well, I had no corals in the tank, so it didn't matter.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But it is a weird thing, man. It's also a seasonal thing. People say that it comes in the springtime and the fall time, and I guess maybe it's got something to do with the pollen counts. I don't know.
Could be. Yeah. There's dissolved organic carbon goes up in the spring because of all the pollen, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and the one bizarre thing is, I've been keeping reef tanks for a long time. For like the first 20 years of my reef keeping career, I never had cyano issues. And for some friggin' reason, the last 10 years, it's been like kind of a thorn in my side. I don't get it, but.
And you have good live rock, right? All that time you've used good live
rock.
Well,
I definitely had.
You had a dry rock.
I had a dry
phase,
rock
right?
phase that just sucked. So.
Whether you're an aquabiomics user like me, or whether you're a skeptic, or whether you're just observing. One thing that Eli's service has done is it's helped people to see the importance of using good live rock in reef tanks.
Absolutely.
Because there was a period where people just went to the really sterile side of things to dry rock, and that has been a disaster.
Yep, absolutely. Not a good experience for me, but you know, some people had fine experiences, not a problem. So, dude, you want to get into the water change experiment you did?
Yeah, so we have, right, we have some more data. Let me, can you...
I brought it up there, forward? Yeah.
Okay, so... This is pretty simple. Basically, we just wanted to ask the question, what happens to the microbiome when you do a big water change? And I did this on my frag tank. I did a 30% water change. And basically, it pulled the planktonic bacteria out of the microbiome. And so on the 31st, you can see I have a very normal looking microbiome. I did a 30% water change. Then 2 days later, I took another microbiome snapshot, and it looks like I removed Flavibacteriaceae, Pelagibacteriaceae, and Alteromotidaceae, all pelagic groups. And the community looked like that. And then a day later, surprisingly, there's a bloom in Pelagibacteriaceae. Perhaps because of Pelagibacteriaceae likes nutrient poor water. So as I added all of that freshly mixed salt water with nitrogen and phosphate of zero, it looks like it caused a spike in Pelagibacteriaceae. And so this is an N equals one. So something different could happen the next time I try it, but we thought it was interesting. And then the graphs on the right show basically what does a tank look like if you don't do anything and just measure the microbiome, you know, 2 days later and then again. So that the control test basically doesn't change very much.
So did this data change anything in terms of your and let me mention, man, your dog sounds very pissed off, by the way.
Oh, can you hear that? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just kidding, man. I'm just busting you.
You can hear that though. Shoot. Sorry about
that.
I was hoping you couldn't hear that.
If you want to bring the dog on the show, that's fine. Fine by me.
Yeah, maybe I'll try that.
Hang on, folks. We're gonna try to get the there. Now everything's hunky dory.
Okay, sorry. Hopefully they shut up now. So, yes. I mean, what was important about it is that it showed us that, I mean, we knew this was true because the Shedd Aquarium had written a paper about what happens to the microbiome when you do a big water change. And it shows that you don't want to do your microbiome sample within a day or two of a big water change. Hmm. Because what you will observe is an abnormal microbiome. If you want to observe your normal microbiome, don't take a sample within a couple days of a water change. At least not if it's a big one. If it's a really small one, maybe it's not going to have as big of an impact.
So what does that say? I mean, basically, it looked to me like it bounced right back a couple of a day or so after the water change. You know, I pretty much the reason why I do water changes is, you know, again, to kind of like, well, to refresh the system, right? Fresh salt water kind of flushes in our natural reefs. That's constantly happening. And you know, so I think to, you know, bringing in new traces via the water changes, but I think it's also important to, well, I don't want to say it's important, but I dose trace elements and minors, you know, to my system 24/7. I also do 5-10% water changes. So that would be an interesting experiment to kind of like see in terms of the trace element dosing and water changes in terms of how that dynamic, you know, goes. Because there seems to be a difference of opinion in terms of like whether water changes alone is enough to bring in, to replenish trace elements, right? So, I don't know. I'm just kind of going off some stream of consciousness here, but
I think what if you look at those data again, it's a, you know, it's a sample size of one. But if you look at those data, doing a big water change appears to boost the Pelagibacteriaceae population and lead to reductions in some of the other populations that you don't want as much of, like the Rhodobacteriaceae. And so if you want to maintain that big pink band like I do, one of the things you can do is do frequent water changes.
So
I think that's what that shows.
So that also helps if you use UV sterilizer, potentially. Maybe not. I guess if the UV is going to zap them, then it's not going to matter.
So it depends. The UV just zaps them. I mean, if you use a UV sterilizer, perhaps having it on intermittently might allow a population of Pelagibacteriaceae to persist. But there's possibly some other things that people with UV sterilizers can do. The Senecococcus, the single-celled cyanobacteria that I mentioned earlier, a friend of mine in Portland, his business is called Nautilus Macro. He is culturing Senecococcus, the single-celled cyanobacteria that is super prevalent in the ocean. And it's one of the main things that corals feed on from the picoplankton, besides Pelagibacteriaceae. So it could be that maybe you can supplement, maybe you can feed your corals by supplementing something like that if you don't have a Pelagibacteriaceae band.
So
it's different than phyto. You know, corals don't eat phyto. Phyto is too big, right? But these are single, little tiny cyanobacteria that the corals actually feed on.
So John Wright's asking, water change or not, here in the UK, lots are not doing water changes and having great results. I guess the question, John, is that are those people doing trace and minor, element dosing in lieu of that water, in those water changes? But so what's your conclusion there? I guess, Andy, you're basically, what you're saying is that water changes are beneficial because you're getting the pink band.
So actually, so this tank right here, I haven't done a water change on this tank, and I don't remember how long it's been, right? Since I've done a water change on that tank, it's been a long time. I use Chris Wood of
Captivate Aquaculture.
Captivate Aquaculture. I use his Excel spreadsheet for trace element dosing, which I do once per month based on ICP, and
they want that attention. There you go. And okay.
This is Sunny.
What's going on there, Sunny?
Sunny is a temperamental Shih Tzu who doesn't like it when the other two dogs wrestle. She gets concerned they're going to hurt each other or something and starts barking. And she doesn't like to be locked outside.
Welcome to the show,
right,
Sonny?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm not a water change guy. I try to do things in a sustainable way. And one of the things that is not sustainable is tons of water and water changes and going through tons of RO water. And so I'm trying to do things without water changes. And so you can let me back up a second. So last year, this tank was showing some symptoms of old tank syndrome. There was beginning to be higher dissolved organic carbon. There was getting to be a big orange band of Rhodobacteriaceae, which is associated with detritus. And I did a Triton endoc test, which said I should do massive water changes. I didn't want to do that because I don't want to rely on big water changes. So what I did is I dosed a ton of purple non-sulfur bacteria and I added a roller mat. Mm. And those two things, I'm not sure which was, because I did made two changes. I'm not sure which was the most important. But it reduced my dissolved organic carbon and it shrunk that Rhodobacteriaceae band. And I started, the signs of old tank syndrome that I was seeing mostly have gone away. And when I do a test of my tank, when I'm not dealing with high phosphate and a hair algae bloom, I see, the microbiome that I'm shooting for. So you can do that without doing big water changes. But big water changes is another way.
Yeah. What about the use of a skimmer? Have you ever tried going skimmerless?
So I have actually on newer systems when nitrate and phosphate are so low. Mm. But all my tanks right now have skimmers. I have tried putting my skimmer on a timer and just having it run at night when I wanted to have more aeration. But I don't know.
Have you done it?
It's too much work, all the timing, everything like that.
Have you ever done a aquabiomics in terms of skimmer, running a system with a skimmer versus no skimmer? Because I think that's a question that I know Sanjay has brought up before in terms of, does a skimmer pull out bacteria?
Yeah, so Sanjay found a lot of bacteria in the skimmate. Yeah. And so the bacteria population probably does go down a bit from skimming, but the number of bacteria that Eli finds in a water sample from a tank with a skimmer is it's a lot of bacteria. It would be interesting to see if there was, say, more pelagic bacteria in a tank without a skimmer, because the skimmer is going to take more pelagic bacteriaceae. Pelagic bacteria out of the system, you would predict, than it would surface bacteria.
Right, because I think a lot of people wonder in terms of when they're dosing bacteria, do you turn your skimmer off for a certain amount of time because you're fearing that that dose bacteria is going to get pulled out of the skimmer. But I don't know, man, you could just go nuts with all the you have kind of gone nuts. You're a big, like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you're a power user of the aquabiomic stuff, but I think it's awesome, man. I think it's great to have data behind these, experiments. We all do experiments, but sometimes we don't have the data behind it. Yeah. So it's good to learn.
So obviously I do way more of these tests than the average person would. I can drive to Eli. Eli just lives 20 minutes down the road from me. I can drive there. It's very, very quick for me to do. What I'm trying to do, because this kind of thing is fun for me. I like to collect data on my tank. And so I want to learn something to help other people. And so I think from studying my systems, if a user starts to see in their measures their microbiome in their tank, and they've got a huge orange band and a little tiny pink band, if they've seen what I've learned from my tank, they would see that as a warning sign and look at ways to help correct that microbiome. And so the more people measure to collect data on their own systems, the more we learn about things like that. Another thing, just a comment, a lot of people don't think about doing a microbiome test when things are looking good in their tank. They just tend to take one when things are looking not so good. And then they don't have a good baseline to compare it to. Now, we know that some systems are different, like Steve Weiss' system looks different than my system when it's doing well. And so somebody might do a microbiome and they don't have a baseline to compare it to. And so they might not get as much out of their tests. So what I recommend is that if you're interested in learning about how the bacterial community can impact coral and fish health in your tank, do a microbiome test when things are looking good. And then wait a while and, look to see if you start to have problems, do another test and see if things look different and if there's any warning signs. If the test finds any pathogens in your water, if you start to see changes in the community from the time when you took the first snapshot.
I think I totally agree with what you're saying, Andy. And I think another thing I would love to see, but this could be a challenge, is studying old tank syndrome. I think everybody always like, a tank gets really old and things start kind of like, corals start struggling and that sort of thing. And so kind of there's like this, assumption that the age of the tank, and it's, I think specifically it could come from sand beds harboring, you know, toxins that build up in the sand bed and that potentially could be leaching out and causing issues. But yeah, I'd be curious to see, like, and it would take a long time to do this, and Eli's service is, you know, relatively young.
Well, I'm going to keep measuring mine.
There you go, man.
So, yeah. So I misspoke earlier. I said my tank was 4 years old. It's 5 years old now. Now I have 5 years data on it. So as we go, eventually it's going to be, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years old. And so we'll be able to see. How does it change?
In terms of sampling, like, you know, I mentioned a sand bed. and I wish Eli was still with us, but yeah, I mean, how can you get into that? I mean, you obviously would have to sample closer to the sand bed or the sand itself to kind of see what's going on with that, right?
So everything that's in the sand bed, because it's a small system relative to the ocean, the surface area per volume in the system is very, very high compared to the ocean. So in a recirculating system, there's a very good chance that things in the sand will make it into the water column. However, deeper in the sand, possibly not. And so one of the things that Eli and I have talked about is doing some alternative sampling where you either, and so currently you sample the pipe, right? You do a water, you take a sample of water and you filter that for the all the water, all the bacteria in the water column, and then you rub a swab on the pipe. And the reason that Eli did that is because every single person with a reef tank has a pipe and they have water, right? Not everybody has sand, right? Not everybody has easy to access live rock. And so yeah. What he's thinking about is expanding it into doing a swab into the sand. Mm. And if you don't have sand, swabbing a dark, a non-exposed surface of the live rock. And so potentially accessing more microbes than you get from just doing the pipe now. So that he's going to test that. We're going to test that in my tank and some other people's tanks to see what we get.
Cool. Matt Reef is asking, do you know, Andy, if there's been any data on continued use of biodigest?
So Telegram sent some samples from different sources, but I don't use biodigest myself. I don't know anybody who uses it regularly. So I'm not sure about that. Maybe somebody who's using, so biodigest is a bacterial supplement that, has been shown to have a number of different families of bacteria in it, more so than most of the bacteria in a bottle products. And so there's quite a bit of interest in using it. I mean, biodigest is great, but it's still nothing like, the live sand you can get from Eli or the live reef rubble in terms of number of different families of microbes. So I would choose the live sand or the reef rubble before I would choose biodigest. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know about any more data for that.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, Andy, I think we're going to put a wrap on the show. Anything else you wanted to add, man? I appreciate you taking the time, and I appreciate Eli taking the time, and also all the stuff you put together in terms of the charts and the data. It's really cool.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. So just one example of how the testing can be useful. Even if you don't happen to see any problems, and getting a baseline is important. So I was talking to Ben Johnson again, Ben, who donated this nice hat to me, talking to Ben Johnson, who has a client who, so Ben takes care of, he has an aquarium maintenance service. He takes care of a number of tanks for clients. And one of his clients got a tank going faster than what Ben would have preferred, added fish and corals pretty fast. Because he likes to, I don't know, he doesn't like to have to wait a long time, doesn't have as much experience in the hobby as Ben. Ben's, you know, an old salt that likes to go slowly like I do. And basically, so the system was set up pretty quickly, and Ben wanted to try out an aquabiomics test on the system. And so he did the 18S, which is the eukaryotic test, the tank DNA test, which is for, you know, fish parasites and other things. And then he did a microbiome test, which is 16S, which is for bacteria, the microbiome. And got the data back for a tank that is looking pretty good, extremely high levels of Vibrio, like some of the highest levels of Vibrio fortis that I've seen in a report. So like basically the microbiome is like purple, huge purple band, all Vibrio with a few other things. So huge amounts of Vibrio in this tank. Also very high levels of Arcobacter. Arcobacter is the bacterium that Eli discovered is associated with brown jelly disease and Euphilia. And I found it on Goniopera in my tank. And also that it's associated with rapid tissue necrosis in millies. And so it's associated with a wide range of coral disease, a disease in a wide range of corals. Very high levels of Arcobacter in the tank, very high levels of Vibrio in the tank. And they just lost a Labuti ras, some kind of ulceration. They had had some corals succumb to brown jelly, but not currently, like not a huge outbreak. And the tank DNA test showed Myxozoans, which you had in your tank from a test a while ago. So Myxozoans are parasitic cnidarians. So they're related to corals and jellyfish, but they have nematocysts. They have the stinging cells, but they don't look anything like corals. They're purely parasitic. And in Oregon here, they cause huge damage to the salmon industry. So they're very capable of killing fish pretty quickly. And so he's got all this stuff in this tank. So I said, Ben, I would get yourself some oxalic acid, put it on the shelf, and monitor that tank very carefully, very closely. So you know what your baseline is now. If you start to see signs of disease, you know what's causing it, and you know what to do. I didn't recommend that he treated it because there's always other risks that come with treating a tank, right? Yeah. Better to wait until you start to see things bad happen.
Yeah.
But then because of you are armed with the knowledge that the test provides, you know exactly what to do.
Yeah. Now, great point. Baseline when the tank is healthy, or at least when you're starting to kind of see.
Or when you thought it was healthy,
right.
At least you don't see anything dying.
Right.
You see that there's potential there to be problems.
Yep. Matt Sharif, thank you very much for that super chat and valuable information. Thanks, guys. Well, with that, man, I think we're gonna wrap it up there, Andy. And Eli is here with us in spirit with the great screenshot of him smiling. So thanks to both of you guys again. I always enjoy these conversations.
All right.
I also want to thank the sponsors one more time, Champion Lighting and Supply. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. I also sent Todd some Reef Bum stickers. So if you mention Reef Bum in your next order, he's going to include a free sticker in the box there for you, so that'd be pretty cool.
I've already got too many of those stickers, Keith.
Yeah, I know. I said when I used to sell out sell corals, every box got a sticker in them. So more stickers out there the better, right? if you already got a Reef Bum sticker, just pass one along to a friend or a reef keeping buddy. That's always a good way to do it. Polar Reef, make sure to check out Polar Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. Imagine a 900-gallon glass drop down aquarium flying in the sky on a giant crane, and then all the anxiety of getting it down a flight of stairs into its final place. That's what Polar Reef is going to show us as a bonus treat. Be on the lookout for a video drop tomorrow highlighting a special guest podcast. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. My third sponsor is Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine ICP Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums, from macro elements, trace elements, and pollutants. You get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. A big thank you to Paul, who's also the moderator, who's the moderator as well as the president of the Boston Reefers Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so important to this hobby. Also want to let you folks know that all episodes of Rap with the Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. My next live stream will be next Tuesday, April 30th, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I will have Sanjay and Mike on again, so that should be a great show. You can check out the full upcoming schedule of guests on reefbum.com under the YouTube section. Until next time, be safe and be well. Later.